Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the third annual Fundraising Success Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success, and I'm pleased to welcome you to our opening keynote, More Than Just Friends, Creating Evangelists to Take Your Cause to the Masses, sponsored by Xerox. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets on this console. To figure out what all the widgets do, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console. Also, as you probably know, each of the sessions in today's conference are eligible for CFRE credits. The tracker document required to apply for CFRE credit for the session can be downloaded via the resource widget on the console. Lastly, if you leave the session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the FSV on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, October 15th, 2012. So let's get to our session. Please welcome Randy Painter, Founder, President, and Chief Executive Officer of CARE2. CARE2 announced recently that its petition site had surpassed 100 million petition signatures to support human rights, the environment, animals, and other causes. And Randy's here to talk about how to nurture relationships and pump up the public not only to donate but to spread the word about your cause. Randy, why don't you start?
Great. Thank you, Margaret. And thank you, everyone. I'm really honored that you've taken the time to be here with me this morning. So as an entrepreneur in the internet philanthropy space for really almost 20 years now, I absolutely love the people that I work with. Everyone has a big heart and believes that they can truly make the world a better place. But I got to tell you, sometimes we're just too darn nice to each other. So I've seen too many nonprofits and social entrepreneurial organizations that have failed, because everyone around them loves the cause, but they really and they really hope they'd be successful, but they failed to point out some bad assumptions in their model. So as Nick Lowe once said, sometimes you got to be cruel to be kind. So in this talk, I'm going to tell it like I see it. So fundraisers are facing some major challenges, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that. But at the same time, there are solutions, and we're going to talk about a couple of simple steps you can take for your organization to succeed. So what I'm going to tell you today is – slide here. So first of all, why current fundraising appeals are falling short. Next, how some organizations are breaking through. We can get the slide to progress here. There we go. Why something called the interest graph is key for breakthrough fundraising appeals. How to build your own interest graph by leveraging core human needs. And then several simple examples of things that you can do to help build a powerful group of evangelists. So my goal is to help you to learn how to create a powerful but friendly army of evangelists for successful fundraising. But first, let me give you a little bit of a quick background about me for some context. So I started CARE2 about 14 years ago to help solve some of the world's most pressing problems. And I believe that at the basis for all change comes from winning the hearts and minds of individuals. So we spent the last 14 years basically doing two things. The first is helping people realize that we're all connected to each other. And as also, we're also connected to all the problems that we face in society. And the second thing is that each and every one of us has the power to take action and make a difference. So along the way, we created the petition site, which for the first time empowered individuals to start online petition campaigns. And at CARE2, we now have over 1,000 nonprofit organizations that we help to recruit donors for. And we've grown to over 20 million members who collaborate to take action on everything from health and sustainability to animal welfare, human rights, the environment, and more. So this morning, we're going to take a look at some of the lessons that we've learned that can help you to create breakthrough fundraising campaigns. But first, the harsh reality. So your fundraising appeals are getting lost in the noise. And I realize that's not exactly news for anyone here, but in the last several years, I think we've hit an inflection point. So a study by the University of California shows that the average person consumes the equivalent of over 10,500 words per hour outside of work. That's about 175 words per minute. A few years back, research firm Yankovich put the number of advertisements the average individual sees per day at over 5,000, and that number is growing rapidly. So the only reason we don't go crazy with all this noise is because we just keep getting better at tuning it out. Meanwhile, nearly 50% of American adults now have a smartphone. So, of course, mobile format means less space to get your message across. And younger generations don't even have a home phone and generally don't respond to direct mail. So while direct mail costs are going up, a recent study by Blackbaud's Target Analytics shows that the number of new donors from direct mail has actually dropped about 15% in the past 5 years. It's about 20% in the last 8 years. So that's certainly not to say that direct mail is dead. It's not. But it's no longer providing the kind of donor acquisition opportunities that it used to. Bottom line, it's getting tougher and tougher to get your message actually through to your target audience. So I've been a student of viral marketing back since 1995 when a couple friends and I kind of cobbled together which ended up a service which ended up being the first online greeting card site. And we immediately realized the power of viral marketing. But back then it was relatively easy to get your message spread via word of mouth. You could rely on clever campaigns, new viral services, and certainly big budgets to break through. But customers quickly got overwhelmed. They learned to sniff out the marketing campaigns, and they tuned out. And, of course, all that excitement about viral marketing bred more unique approaches, bigger budgets, pushier campaigns, and we've ended up with this downward spiral of more volume and lower response rates. So today there are literally armies of 20-somethings to social media sites like these guys at BuzzFeed or HuffPo and many others that do nothing but look for kind of the earliest signs of viral stories. They use analytics to optimize titles, images, and stories, and to make their stories catch the eye of your target audience before your message does. So great content and quality messaging is getting drowned out more than ever before, and it's only going to get worse. It's inevitable. It's the tragedy of the commons. Nobody owns the channel, so everyone fights as hard as they can to get attention. So yet some messages are getting through, and there are campaigns that are doing well. So let's take a look at some of what's breaking through the noise. Well, one measure that's a great indicator of what's resonating is how viral a message is. In other words, how well it spreads via word of mouth. So the message obviously has to have been read and struck a chord if it's going to be shared. So if it's compelling enough to share, we know it's breaking through the noise. Most of what we hear about that has gone viral are these kind of big mainstream news stories or humor related to popular memes. So memes are kind of images, beliefs, or other content that gets passed from one person to the next, often being modified around a theme. So there are also, in addition to some of those kind of silly stuff and the news stories, there are a number of causes and cause-related issues that have also gone viral. And the most widespread are usually those that are offensive to our cultural sense of identity or are visually startling or truly, you know, extraordinary stories. But, you know, the poster child has got to be the Kony 2012 campaign this year. So while it's amazing what Invisible Children was able to do with that video, I actually don't want to talk much about sensations like that because, one, they've already been analyzed by pretty much every viral marketing consultant out there. But more importantly, these kind of mega phenomena are not really predictable and not repeatable. So if you swing for the fences like that every time, I can guarantee you your organization's probably going to go broke before you ever hit a home run like that. So what I want to focus on today is how you can build a fundraising engine that will break through the noise and is repeatable. So, and let's face it, you know, if you do, unless you do a lot of walkathons or charity event fundraisers, the messages that are breaking through and spreading friend to friend to friend are usually not fundraising appeals. So if viral marketing is a good measure of what's resonating and breaking through, and fundraising appeals almost never go viral, you know, how is a fundraising professional supposed to reliably get their message out? And that's what we're going to talk about today. But first, let's look at proof that viral marketing can result in actually great fundraising results. So I apologize in advance for this seemingly very self-serving example, but it's one I know well, because Care2 has never done any advertising and almost no paid promotion. So this is a pure example of viral marketing for fundraisers. So over the past 14 years at Care2, we've had over 500 million unique visitors to our site. And from those, we've recruited about 25 million donor leads for more than 1,000 nonprofit organizations, which will produce, at the very minimum, about $250 million in donations. So how does that work? Well, we run campaigns for our nonprofit clients that go viral. These are almost never direct fundraising appeals. They're usually in the form of asking someone to sign a pledge, take a quiz, or maybe sign a petition. So the viral nature of these campaigns pulls traffic back to our site and through what we call conversion funnels, in other words, the quiz or the petition. So this allows us to recruit donor leads, usually as email signups for the organization's e-newsletter. So our clients then cultivate these leads to turn them into donors. The initial communication with the donor leads is through email. If you've heard email marketing is suffering that same kind of media overload, Faith, that I was just talking about, well, we're not seeing that on the email side for sure. In fact, email is still absolutely core for fundraising when used effectively, and we'll talk about more about that later. So viral memes can be great for raising awareness, but unless you capture the email addresses or the bare minimum Facebook likes or Twitter followers, you're going to have no way to capitalize on all that passion and interest in the future. So let's look at the value of those email addresses. So according to actual client data from Convio, which is now part of Blackbaud, the value of an email address is in the first year alone worth $4.98 to $17.42, depending on the vertical. When you extend that over the lifetime of those leads, the average email address will contribute $13 to more than $48. And personally, I think there's a huge amount of additional upside potential for organizations that use those names most effectively. And this is really what this discussion is all about here. So why do leads from viral, non-fundraising appeals generate such returns? Well, to capture those leads, the prospective donors need a compelling reason to share their personal information. This is why online actions such as pledges and petitions work so effectively. There's a logical reason why you're sharing your email, name, and other contact information. So a study done by the Bureau of Economic Research shows that individuals who take action on behalf of an organization online are 7 times more likely to make a donation to that organization than individuals who have not. And why is that? Well, two reasons primarily. One is a filtering effect, and the second is really kind of self-rationalization. So basically, if I've taken action, and especially if that's public, and later that organization asks me for a donation, my mind says, well, I took action for this organization in the past, and I wouldn't have wasted my time, so it must be a good organization. So let's look at some examples of campaigns that are resonating, breaking through, and going viral. So the examples I'm going to talk about are successful. They're not the Kony 2012 home run non-repeatable type, but they're solid hits that are achievable and repeatable. So let's start with a modest example. From the British version of Kickstarter, which is a, kind of a crowdfunding platform where individuals can post projects they're trying to raise money for and get other individuals to donate directly to the project, Steve Byrne was looking to raise about £2,000, which is about $3,000, to make an inventory of the papers of Hamish Henderson, a Scottish poet, political activist, and songwriter. You know, for most of us, that's not exactly as compelling a story as a disaster relief appeal or, frankly, for that matter, as share-worthy as a cat video. Yet, Steve raised more than 200% of what he was looking for, nearly $7,500, or an average of about $60 per donor, which I suspect Hamish Henderson would have been pretty happy with. The next example we're going to talk about is a seal petition, which was started by an individual at the Island Wildlife Natural Care Center in Canada. So there's an aquarium in Quebec that had captured two pup seals, which were named Zach and Mika, for the summer. And at the end of the summer, the aquarium was actually shutting down, and so they were actually going to kill the poor seals. So this individual posted this petition, and within about 2 weeks, they had gotten 140,000 signatures and over 170,000 Facebook likes. So that pressure really forced the aquarium to release the seals rather than kill them. Next example is Charity Water. So they have something called the Give Up Your Birthday Pledge, where individuals are asking their friends to make a donation to Charity Water on their behalf for their birthday rather than receive a gift. And you can see that over 18,000 people signed up for this pledge. And finally, many of you have probably seen these series of viral videos from The Girl Effect, which is basically trying to raise awareness to end poverty for adolescent girls in developing countries. So, you know, let's look at why these campaigns were able to break through the noise. They all share two primary traits that not only made them a one-off success, but also makes them repeatable. So the first one is they all had a compelling message or a great story. And great stories is kind of the topic du jour. I feel like everywhere I turn, everyone's talking about how important it is to create a great campaign story so that people are going to want to share it. And there's no doubt that a great story can make a big difference. But because you've all probably heard a lot about this, I actually want to talk about another factor, which is at least as important and really not talked about enough. So the second reason that these campaigns were able to break through the noise and go viral is that they leveraged existing interest graphs. So you say what? What's an interest graph? Well, we hear a lot of discussion about the power of social networks, and how key they are to make social media go viral. So social networks rely on friend connections, and those connections usually come about from individuals meeting each other face-to-face. These friend connections form the perfect connection points or vectors to spread mainstream humor, news, and other memes because they appeal to the majority of our friends. This is why we see these huge explosions of popular memes that seemingly everyone hears about. If you map out those connections, they look something like this, which is called the social graph. However, most people don't surround themselves only with friends who share their passion for protecting, let's say, the northern spotted owl, or building clean drinking wells in Africa, or supporting music programs in secondary schools. So if we share a story about our favorite personal cause to our friends, if we even decide to do that, chances are it's not going to get the same positive response as when we share something with more universal appeal. This is where the interest graph comes in. So the interest graph is similar to the social graph in that it shows individuals and connections. But these relationships are formed around certain topics or interests, and it's very likely that the individuals are separated by geography and they've never actually met in person. So in this example, the purple there might represent just those people who are against drilling for oil in the Arctic. So some of these connections are Karen's real-world friends, but others she may only know or to be connected to through online forums, blogs, or Twitter. If you want to spread a message about protecting seals, and you want to tap into the interest graph of wildlife lovers, and ideally seal lovers, and those interest graphs do exist. So same thing is true for people who love to hike in the Alps, for individuals who love 15th century Italian sculpture, or those who want to abolish the death penalty. So to recap, the social graph illustrates friend connections, while the interest graph illustrates connections between people that share specific interests, regardless of location or friendship. So if you think back to that, you know, rather arcane example of the crowdfunded project for the Hamish Henderson Archive, the reason that they were successful was that they had already established their interest graph. So Steve Byrne, the founder of the campaign, said, "Our success lay in having a strong group of interested people, which we had cultivated for a significant period via our Facebook page prior to launching our project." So, well, I said earlier that I didn't want to talk about Kony 2012 because it's such an outlier in terms of how successful it was from a viral growth perspective. Someone recently sent me this crazy-looking chart that looks like some sort of constellation map or something. It was so cool, I really wanted to share it with you. So there's a perception that the Kony video was an overnight sensation, that Invisible Children created such a compelling video that as soon as they posted it, it exploded across the web. And they've actually now got a new video out that suggests something like this. But that's not exactly true. You see, it turns out the folks at Invisible Children had done a lot of legwork, building up relationships, in particular with a network of college and high school students, many in Christian communities and in the rural South. So the good folks at socialflow.com analyzed the initial 5,000 tweets related to the Kony 2012 campaign and then plotted their location on this chart. So what you see are huge groupings of these very early tweets clustered around schools where they had spent not just months but years building their network. So these early bursts gave the campaign that initial buzz and traction that made it appear like an overnight success. Okay, but let's put Kony aside because regardless of this crazy-looking chart, I think there are six reasons the interest graph is key to fundraising. And given the importance of interest graphs, I think your organization should make sure to build its own interest graph, or if you prefer, you can call them network of interested individuals. So by build, I don't mean hire a bunch of programmers to develop a software platform. There are a variety of ways you can build your organization's interest graph on top of an existing network like Facebook, Twitter, or others. So the important thing is you need to have ready access to a group of individuals who share a passion for your cause. The stronger your relationship is to them and their relationship is to each other, the more reliably you'll be able to tap into this to raise awareness, run advocacy campaigns, and fundraise. So note that this is different from just having an email list, although that's a great place to start. So email lists are broadcast models, you know, one-way communication. As you probably figured out, you know, in kindergarten, you don't have a relationship if you're the one doing all the talking. So relationships mean your members are interacting and truly part of your organization. And ideally, they're interacting with each other as well. So the first reason that interest graphs are key is that for your campaign to break through the noise is that you need critical mass fast. In other words, enough people to create the perception or social proof this is a meaningful campaign. In this world of fast-moving news, getting a quick start can mean the difference between success and failure. So there's actually some quantitative evidence of this impact as well. So a study from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania found that a $10,000 fundraising project on the crowdfunding site Kickstarter, holding everything else constant, if you had 10 Facebook friends, you would only have a 9% chance of succeeding. If you had 100 Facebook friends, your chance jumps to 20%. And if you had 1,000 Facebook friends, your chance of succeeding is now 40%. The second reason interest graphs are key to fundraising success falls into the realm of social psychology. So as social beings, most of us get motivated by the opportunity to be part of something greater than oneself. And the more we have a kind of a common history and a sense of connection, the more powerful that effect is. So we all know how collective action can achieve great results, so it's exciting to be part of that path to success. The third reason your organization should own its interest graph is based on how our brains are wired. So if you've been to a marketing conference over the past few years, you've probably heard a lot of talk about neuromarketing and maybe the reptilian brain, which basically refers to the oldest part of our brain, how it makes snap decisions that drive much of our thinking. So the first way we tend to notice the impact of this is via email or blog subject lines. As we all know, the words we use in a subject line can make a huge difference in terms of our fundraising results. So how does an interest graph actually impact subject lines? Well, your organization may be able to write subject lines that are going to get the best results from the average 45-year-old woman living in New England. But if you go across a large donor list, you're never going to be able to reference to Eleanor that the two of you were just talking about a related topic the other day, or that Mary loves to be the first one to know about a new issue and incessantly checks her Facebook personal messages, or that Naomi recently really respects a certain authority on your cause. So this is the kind of personalization that only friends can and do use to persuade their friends to read what they're sending. The members of your interest graph know better than anyone at your organization how to influence their friends. The second reason the interest graph will help you break through the noise because snap decisions are made on who we first hear a message from. So there's a hierarchy for who we pay attention to when we see messages. We pay most attention to messages we've sent ourselves. So, for example, a reminder we've set up. So if you can get your donors to remind themselves to donate to you again in the future, you're probably going to get strong results. Next, we pay attention to what our friends are saying. If you hear about a campaign via connections in your trusted graph, interest graph, you're likely to be a lot more receptive to that same message than if it was sent directly from an organization, independent of the actual text used in the message. So part of the reason for that is called anchoring or framing, as in who said it immediately sets the lens through which you interpret the message. So if you're interested in learning more about this, I recommend the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. And one of the examples he brings up is just, it's a fascinating example of the anchoring effect. He writes, Amos, who's his co-researcher, and I once rigged a Wheel of Fortune. It was marked from 0 to 100, but we had it built so that it would stop only at 10 or 65. One of us would stand in front of a small group, spin the wheel, and ask them to write down the number on which the wheel stopped, which, of course, was either 10 or 65. We then asked them two questions. First one was, is the percentage of African nations among UN members larger or smaller than the number you just wrote? And the second question was, what is your best guess of the percentage of African nations in the UN? So while the spin of the Wheel of Fortune had nothing to do with the question and should have no influence over the answer, it did. The average estimate of those who saw 10 and 65 were 25 and 45% respectively. So talk about power. You know, anchoring is such a powerful influence, and we don't even realize it's happening. So owning your interest graph is key to helping best anchor your message for success. So the fourth reason you want to build your interest graph is because there's tremendous leverage in it. Not only is the old one-way kind of broadcast model of fundraising getting drowned out in all the noise, but it's also a very inefficient way to go. So as the saying goes, many hands make light work. And in an interest graph, you have an audience that isn't just open to receiving your appeals, but they're passionate about doing whatever it takes to help out. So there are a lot of ways that organizations are leveraging their networks. So some organizations, of course, do walkathons or events like that to raise awareness and raise money. Organizations like Hands-On Network leverages their network for skills-based volunteering. Donors Choose leverages networks of teachers and schools to raise funds. Charity Water has done a fantastic job of using Twitter and social media to amplify their message and raise funds. And then, of course, Kickstarter and Indiegogo and others like that are facilitating crowd fundraising. And this leverage also means that these can be very cost-effective ways of helping further your organization's mission. And at the same time, some of these models are actually threatening to disintermediate the old top-down fundraising models and raise expectations among individual funders that they should have a personal connection and direct impact on the organization itself. So not only can you use your interest graph, you should experiment and move toward kind of meeting these new expectations with a leveraged model.
Randy, this is Margaret. Can I interject for a minute? Could you please give the name of the book that you mentioned again?
Oh, sure. That was Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow.
Okay,
thank you.
It's
Amazon on the top 10 or something like that at this point.
So
some of you may be thinking, all right, great. I've got a small, underfunded organization. How on earth are we supposed to build some huge network? Well, the good news is you actually don't it doesn't take a lot of staff, and you actually don't need a huge network. So all social networks, or in this case, interest networks, tend to have engagement levels in the shape of a power law. In other words, a few individuals do the vast majority of the work. So we call these folks the stars of the show, and the rest of the folks feel connected basically by being part of the audience. If you look at another example of Wikipedia, so they've got 70 million unique visitors to Wikipedia each month. But at the heart of that, there are only 687 active editors. So you see there's just tremendous leverage in this model. So the fifth reason to build your interest graph is the impact on your brand. So today, an organization's brand is defined as much, if not more, by what others are saying about it versus what the organization is saying it is. So prospective donors have been fooled too many times to trust an organization that is unknown by their social or interest networks. There's a great fear of being manipulated, and particularly among younger generations, those traditional solicitation channels of direct mail and phone feel manipulative. So hearing about a cause or fundraising appeal from friends, however, feels more authentic and leaves them feeling with a sense of control. So individuals are much more guarded with direct communications if no relationship is in place. And that's true across all generations. So the more you surround your donors and prospective donors with others who also support you, the greater your credibility will have with them. The sixth and final reason that you need to own your interest graph is because you'll be able to raise a lot more money from your donors if you do. So I'll admit, I get frustrated sometimes by the amount of churn and burn fundraising I see out there, where other than for major donors, it seems like nearly the entire focus of some organizations is on getting as many leads into the top of the funnel as possible and immediately squeezing as much out of them as possible with little to no energy spent on actually establishing a true relationship with donors and even leads who might eventually convert to becoming donors. Now, before the internet, that might have been the most effective approach, but that's really not true today. So as I discussed at the beginning, the difficulty of getting your message to break through all that noise should be reason enough to abandon this churn and burn approach. It's simply getting too expensive for you to compete for everyone's attention. But equally as important is that the donor that is well connected to not only your organization but other members is a donor that is likely to stick around. And the longer they stick around, the greater their lifetime value. So in a 36-month study by consulting firm M&R, they found that only about 45% of the donations from an email list came in during the first year, and about 75% had come in by the end of year two. And quite a few of the donors that actually donated in years two and three had actually not donated in year one. And it's interesting to note that although of the roughly million records in this study, that they all came in via email. Only about 60% of the donations came in online. About 15% came in via phone, and then the rest, 25%, came in via direct mail. So if you want to make sure you can reliably get your message to resonate and break through the noise, you have two choices. You can either build it from scratch, or you can work with a company that already owns part of your interest graph and can tap into it for you. And essentially, that's what we're doing for our nonprofit clients. But either way, in the long run, you want to own your interest graph. And by own, I mean that you want to build a core network of individuals who share your passion for your cause so that when you need help, they're eager to get started. So I always recommend kind of starting by modeling what works. So if you want to look at a model that is doing an amazing job with engagement and retention, just look at World of Warcraft. So individuals have collectively spent over 6 million years playing World of Warcraft. So imagine what could be accomplished if we could somehow channel all that passion and engagement for good. And, of course, the people playing World of Warcraft aren't just spending their time. They're also spending a lot of money. So Blizzard Entertainment, the parent company, earns hundreds of millions of dollars a year from people playing World of Warcraft. So if you're thinking that engagement, that those techniques that engage the average online gamers won't motivate your audience, I'd recommend taking a second look. Because games like World of Warcraft, Farmville, and Cityville are called social games because they allow people to play either real-time or asynchronously with their friend. And the average demographic of a person playing an online social game is actually a woman aged 48 years old, which, of course, is the bullseye for a lot of fundraisers. So these games tend to use tried-and-true psychological techniques to get players engaged. And now some of you may say, well, but those are games. That's not fundraising. And that's true, but many of these techniques used by games to get you hooked are very much transferable to non-gaming situations. So let's take a look at how to do that. So I recommend starting with the 6 core human needs. Now, all of us have these same 6 core needs at our core. And the first one is basically the need to feel certainty or security. But if we're too certain or too secure, we tend to get bored, so we need a little bit of variety. In addition, we need to feel significant or significance. We need to feel like we are connected or loved. We need to feel like we are growing, and we need to feel like we are able to contribute. The most important in the Western Hemisphere tend to be significance and connection. Now, if you can kind of really meet one of these core needs for your audience, you're really onto something. If you can meet 2 of these core needs, you're just going to have incredible engagement and retention. And, you know, this is why Farmville was so successful. It's not just that it was designed to get people to post, you know, notes on friends' walls. And it's not exactly like, you know, watering your virtual garden is the most exciting game in the world. It's because when you play games like that, you feel like you're connecting and collaborating with your friends. At the same time, you're able to kind of achieve new levels and certain awards, which makes you look significant in front of your friends as well. So, you know, you can see that this kind of social and viral stuff, it's not just trendy or fleeting. We are wired to respond to these kind of mechanics. So the third core human need to really focus on in this space is of course, contribution. So let's look at a case study of how you can leverage these core human needs, you know, in a model that's going to get people engaged to take action. So this is on Kirtu, we've built something called Butterfly Rewards. It's basically a loyalty program, kind of a frequent flyer program for people who take action. And when they take action, they earn credits. They can then redeem those credits for gifts that make the world a better place, such as they can buy a day of clean drinking water for a family in need, or they can plant a tree in Ethiopia. Now, there are a lot of different ways that they can take action or earn these credits. They can post a comment, they can share something, or they can, let's say, take our daily action. Now, the way that we leverage those core human needs through this model is that when people take action on our site, they have the sense that they are contributing, they're doing something good for society. We then take the gifts that they have given and post them actually on their personal profile page so that everybody else can see that they've given these gifts, that these people are taking action, that they're good people, and, you know, it's something to be proud of, basically. So others see these and helps them to feel a sense of helps the people that have made these gifts to feel a sense of significance. And in addition, we have something called Green Stars, which basically are a simple way for members to say thank you to each other. So that helps them to create the sense of connection between each other. So these also have – we know that these drive meaningful results because we've seen it on in our own metrics. So when we launched Butterfly Rewards, we saw about a 7 times increase in the number of comments – And for cause marketing campaigns where we use the Butterfly Rewards program, we see about a 5 to 9 times increase in the amount of click-throughs versus the average campaign. So let's look at some other examples. So how can you build your interest graph and meet the core needs of your donors and prospective donors? Well, the specific answer depends on the particulars of your audience. So the most important thing you can do is to provide simple actions. In other words, start with the easiest ways possible because it really starts to build that relationship. So here's an example from Upworthy, which is kind of a social cause and news sharing site. So what they've done is when you go to their site, they ask you this question, which pretty much everyone who goes to the site is going to answer, I agree, I support equality for all. And when you click on that, I agree, you then see the opportunity to sign up for their email list. Now, I can guarantee you, because someone has just said in their mind, yes, I agree, I am connected to you, I appreciate, I am kind of one with this organization, Upworthy. I am going. They're more likely to add their email address here and sign up for that newsletter than if they had simply asked for the newsletter subscription in the first place. So that simple action actually helped to develop that relationship at a very light level, but it was enough to increase the number of signups that they're going to get. Another, a lot of folks are using Twitter to engage with their audience, but I actually recommend that if you do use Twitter, don't just push information out to them. Also, try to push opportunities for them to engage. So here's another example of using Twitter for basically getting people to engage actually offline with your organization. So a lot of folks are using Facebook. Lots of ways to interact with your members on Facebook and for your members to interact with each other through commenting or liking or what have you. We've got another example. Actually, this is kind of a new thing that's my autism team. So Autism Speaks recently teamed up with a social network for parents of children with autism called My Autism Team, and they're really directly tapping into this concept of the interest graph. So that's a little bit more involved. It's not, it's certainly more involved, the relationship there from a business perspective, but it's a great way to tap into the interest graph. Another example would be AARP's You've Earned a Say campaign, where they're basically asking their members to send messages to the presidential candidates. We've got here's New Belgium Brewery. They have something called the Tour de Fat, which is basically local festivals combined with fundraisers. And so if you can do something where you can get people to engage offline, that's particularly powerful. Caring Across America, they're asking members to send a message to moderators of the presidential debates. The Lutheran World Relief is making a bigger ask for people to make quilts and send to folks in developing nations. Water for Children is asking people to send e-cards for World Toilet Day, which to highlight poor sanitation and unsafe water. So some of these ideas are simpler than others, but they all help people to engage and build a true rapport with the organization. Most of them also help people feel that they're contributing something other than money. And they also help to establish the expectation that the organization and the individual will be communicating with each other in the future. So the next really kind of amazingly powerful way to create a truly committed and powerful group of evangelists for your organization is to get your members talking to and appreciating each other. So if we think back to that previous slide on the core human needs, connection and significance were really the two most powerful needs. So while your organization can thank members for what they do, almost nothing will meet those core human needs better than the surprise and authenticity of another member's appreciation. So at Care2, we let our members send each other green stars of gratitude, and at Facebook, people can like someone's update. I recently saw on LinkedIn they have now offered the ability to congratulate someone for a promotion. You can use, comments work great for this also. You can ask your Twitter followers to, mention another follower they appreciate. But I think, again, with a little bit of creativity, there are lots of ways to get your members appreciate each other, and which will help you to build this incredibly powerful network. So we've gone through a lot of material here today, and so I just want to kind of do a quick recap here. So To break through the noise and create a powerful army of evangelists for successful fundraising, you want to make sure you build your interest graph. And that's going to give you critical mass fast to get your message out there to break through the noise. In addition, it creates a shared sense of purpose, which is going to drive participation. It also allows you to positively frame those snap decisions that determine results. It provides great leverage. It helps to create brand authenticity and trust. And it also will drive or increase donor retention, which is certainly going to increase lifetime value. So to do that, model what works, focus on the core human needs, engage then with simple actions, and finally, facilitate member-to-member appreciation. That's kind of one that we don't hear a lot of talk about, but I think is incredibly powerful. So these slides are going to be available for download later, and I welcome any questions. You can send me an email request anytime. Happy to respond, and I want to thank you all. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to me this morning.
Randy, thanks so much. We have a couple of minutes. I was wondering if you could talk to our audience about you've given us plenty of information. What would you think is the single most, let's say, damaging factor that is holding organizations back from really engaging the way you've told us they need to be engaging?
Oh, wow. I think there are a lot of different factors. I think in general there is a tends to be a really short-term focus that is so much about kind of the return on investment over a very short period. And the reality is that building relationships does pay off generally over a slightly longer period than a lot of organizations have kind of the time, at least their initial perspective is that they have the time to spend on this. So, but I think that if they, do a little bit now and kind of continue to build it, it doesn't take that much work along the way. And particularly if you can get your members talking to each other, there's so much leverage in that you end up kind of building this, and it does take history also. It takes time for this to play out. But the longer you go, the more that you can build those relationships, the more it's going to pay off in the long run. So I think it's that short-term time constraint or perceived time constraint, I'll say, that is keeping most organizations from doing this. But I think in the long run, they're going to definitely make a lot more in terms of donations and have a much larger advocacy force if they can focus on these relations at the same time.
Now, this is sort of playing off of what you just said, but I know from speaking to people from organizations of all sizes, large, small, old, new, a lot of the problem that they have, especially when it comes to social media and engagement on social media, is they're up against leaders who say, well, if it's not going to bring in donations tomorrow, we're just not going there. How would you address that?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is probably to look at the lifetime value of those donor leads that you're bringing in. So, you can that's part of it. At the same time, looking at just the escalating costs of actually doing the acquisition. So because it is getting harder and harder to break through, it's becoming more and more important to retain. And the more you retain, the more dollars you're going to get. So I think they're going to have to be able to convince the board, basically, that over the long term, there may be a challenge in the first year, but over the several-year period, you're going to see significantly more in the way of donations and a lot more influence if you can create this core. It doesn't have to be a huge core, but just a core of individuals who are true evangelists for your organization.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Randy. We are just about out of time. On behalf of Fundraising Success Magazine and Xerox, I want to thank you again for attending the session. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees. You can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey to let us know about your experience today. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day today. We have several wonderful sessions lined up, and we encourage you to view as many of them as you can. If you can't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view them at your convenience in the on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months starting on Monday. Have a great day, everyone, and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.